And I got a message from Cal and Doug that they have a storm hit them a little bit. They get a lot of snow, so I don't think they're going to be able to join today. But, you know, we're recording everything, so hopefully once they get back online, they'll hear it. So,
just... go to the archives to hear it?
Yeah. It's got the audio link. So the sound's okay from there? Hello? Sounds good.
Sounds good here,
too.
Okay. Right. Is Carolyn on yet?
Oh, yeah, I just got on. Hey, Rabbi.
Hey, how are you doing, Carol?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay.
Did you guys get a lot of snow?
No, we got about an inch. Nothing really significant.
Oh.
Where are you located, Carolyn?
Well, I'm in the Central Way, which is in the Seattle area.
So I heard that you got, how many inches you guys got?
We got around, 6 inches or so here.
Uh-huh. They made it out to be a lot. The news was making it out to be like the most amount of snow you got in years. Is that true? Well,
ice on Thursday.
All right, yeah, that's the problem. It's heavy. Okay, so I guess we're ready to start. And we're continuing with, we're discussing in the last chapter. And we had, you know, a couple of questions. We covered, I think, a good amount last week in terms of getting some inroads as to why King Solomon, at the end, he says, because he sums up in 12:7, where he says clearly a person returns to the earth. And then he concludes that thought by saying the futility of futilities. Does the collector say, the collector mean the one who amassed all this knowledge or put together the books, or Koheles, that's what this Hebrew name refers to. Or, like we also mentioned, like Rabbi Chait explained, that he spoke over his ideas in groups of people. So that means a kahila from Koheles, the same word. But why would he tell us that he taught over his ideas in groups of people, of the wise men of Israel? To show that whatever he wrote was bounced off educated people, intelligent people. It wasn't just his subjective whims. So the reason why he says, that we said this last week, the reason why he says, after he talks about that the person returns to the earth, and then he says, futility of futilities, he means to say that now that you can grasp, now that the person has come this far in his book, and he realizes that life is temporary, so he should be able to grasp this idea, that going after the physical world, other than how it contributes to the person's eternal life, is a futility. So the physical world as an ends in itself is what King Solomon said was futile. All right, now, and again, in the beginning of the work, Rabbi Chait again had quoted the question that they asked, how could King Solomon say, because he said this in the beginning of the work, that the futility of futility is the physical world. And they counted up how many times in that first verse he says the word futility, and it comes out between the plural forms and the singular forms, a plural form of the word meaning at least two, and a singular meaning one, so they counted seven. So they said, how could Koheles be attributing a futility critique of the physical which was created in the 7 days? And God said in the beginning of Genesis, after every day, that it's good. So God's saying every single one of the 6 days that it's good. And King Solomon is saying that it's futile. So the answer that Rabbi Chait gave was, as we're saying, that that we're quoting him on, that when you use the physical world as an ends in itself, then it's futile. It doesn't have a purpose in and of itself. It only has a purpose in as much as a person is targeting his perfection and coming close to God. Okay. So that's why he says over here, so since a person is temporary by design, so therefore, contemplate the idea that if you go after the physical world as an end in itself, that's futile. That's what he says in verse 12:8. Did somebody have a question? Okay. Then he goes on. And we're reviewing a bit, but there's more points here. It says in 12:9, did somebody have a question? I hear somebody talking. Okay, sorry. Okay. And he says in 12:9, and in addition, and on top of this, meaning on top of what? In addition to the fact that he said that things are futile, in order to compound that point, he tells you that Kohelis, the King Solomon, was wise. So that the critique that you're hearing now, and he's telling you that it's coming from an intelligent person. So he's reviewing this point, reiterating that point, but we wonder why he says that. We don't see at the end of his other works a conclusionary note that King Solomon was wise, or the end of King David's Psalms that King David was wise. What is it saying it over here that at the very end of the work he says, and on top of that, in addition, that Kohelis was wise? And based on, like Sforno said, based on the wisdom that he had, that he was so wise and wiser than all others, he went out of his way to teach more than the other people because he realized the obligation that comes with the wisdom. So he taught the people. He caused them to hear and to analyze, because wisdom is not just like an open and closed book and it's a discrete amount of content. The way you gain more wisdom is by analysis. That's what he says. He caused them to hear and to analyze. And to deliberate. And therefore he arranged many metaphors. Like we said last week, a metaphor calls in the person's current reservoir of knowledge. When you're trying to catapult them to newer areas, so a person could be lost with no bearings. So the way you enter a person into a new area, a new sphere of knowledge, is by calling upon what he already knows and uses examples, and he builds one step upon another, but using the current reservoir of knowledge or the current symbols or things that he's familiar with. And from there you can increase the person's knowledge. Okay. But you see that he says, interesting, it says in addition that Kohelis was wise. I'm wondering if the fact that it says was, that he's referring to the fact that he too passed on, meaning he's trying to underscore the very concept of the temporal nature of our earthly stay. Because without that, you can't have a true value system. And that's why he says at the very end of the book, he eases the person into it. He goes to his eternal home, but then he makes it just as a slow way of easing a person into this concept, right? We talked about this. That's in the end of 12:5. But then he says it more literal, that a person returns to the dust. He gives it very clear, without the metaphor of eternal home, he says the person returns to the dust, and the spirit returns to God, meaning the person will give an accounting for his actions. So perhaps in 12:9, he refers to the fact that he is no longer, meaning he was wise. And that underscores the idea that the person passes. Because you see that maybe the reason he has to talk about this is because when you're confronting a person on the most delicate or bothersome, I should say, piece of knowledge about themselves, that they're not going to be here forever, that's faced with the most defense. And even why you're trying to educate the person, and you're telling the person that you're going to return to the dust and so on, a person is going to fight that tooth and nail. So he has to be clear about this, that listen, even the person writing this left, he's no longer around, that he was wise. So not only was he wise, but it's in the past. But you see, that's something which has to be brought home to the person. So perhaps that's why it gives at the end of this work, and not the other works, a reference to the fact that King Solomon was wise. It talks about him in the past, and it talks about the fact that he was very intelligent. In order that when the person is confronted with having to face with his own mortality, the person has to face that. So the way to get a person to accept that and to really embrace that truth and not to fight it, this is, you show them that even the person who wrote this, King Solomon, he's no longer with us. But you also talk about the fact that he was a great intellect. So you're giving an emotional identification for the person to see that this, just like King Solomon here is talking about, every person passes, he too passed, so it could make it more acceptable to the person. But on top of that, this person was a great, great intellect. And if he's telling you these things, don't try to fight it because of your subjective desire for that immortality.
That's a natural reaction, Rabbi.
Yeah, it's natural.
But
we're not, it's, I don't think a child can really grasp.
No, they can't. It's too developed. They haven't got the experience yet.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Okay.
Rabbi, I was just wondering whether this is just kind of noting this, how wise Solomon really was, because of course we don't usually, he was very wise, but he was wise enough to know that if you're wise, you can't stay in a silo, that he was still trying to acquire additional knowledge from his students and from people who was teaching, and because you always, as part of like a harusa, you always stand to gain more than what you're giving, because you don't know what the response of the students can be, so you gain more knowledge that way as well.
So you're answering what exactly? Am I clear?
What I'm saying is that, so it starts off by saying, and besides being wise, he continued to impart knowledge with the thought that he could still acquire additional knowledge, because by talking to people, you acquire their knowledge as well.
Yes, that's true. Yes, what the rabbi said. You learn much from your rabbis, even more from your peers, but the most you learn is from your students. Are you familiar with that one, Nachshon?
Yes, Rabbi.
Yeah. Right.
The next question, Rabbi, what are you learning from us?
A lot.
A lot.
Yeah, I'm still working on a response for Doug's question from a few weeks ago, but because we're going through these words of King Solomon, so carefully, and we know the Torah was written by God. How do we know that this was written divinely? That we should, that it demands such an analysis. So you see that one question. There was a lot of research that I did, and I went over with some friends and discussed it with Rabbi Mann, and hopefully by this week I'll have a response. I'm going to write up, so I'll share it on the site. You look at the, and maybe we'll have it in the Jewish Times this week. It'll be a response to Doug's question.
Thank you.
Didn't you post somewhat of a response in the blog?
Yes, but not fully. Doug gave a response to that, and I'm going to post his response plus my response. So there'll be two more entries coming. But I think I'll formulate it into one article and as well. So it might be easier reading that way, too. All right, so now we're in verse 10, where he says further that King Solomon desired to find words of desire. So the word chefetz in Hebrew also means what desire, I mean the desire of something. So what does it mean? Let's just read the whole verse. That King Solomon sought to find words of desire, and he wrote words that were upright and words of truth. So what does Ibn Ezra say on this? He says, King Solomon sought words of desire. This is the higher level of knowledge. Until it is found, and the matter is as follows, he says, meaning what does it mean, words of desire? What is the desire in this object that it was created in this way, and why that way? Again, the knowledge that King Solomon was searching for was, what was the desire in this thing, any given object, anything, any creation? Meaning, why was it created? Why was this thing created, and why in this way? Two questions. Meaning, when King Solomon's writing all this, and this again is a summation of what he wrote, so Ibn Ezra is saying, what does it mean that King Solomon sought words that were desirous? I mean, the desire means not necessarily desired by people, but words of desire, meaning words that explain the desire of the creator behind creating something. Which means that until you understand God's intent, you don't really understand the subject. Why was this species made? Why was it made this way? So two things he's saying. And this is what really is a very general overview. But it really points to the definition of something. Meaning knowledge is when you know something, that means you know its purpose in creation. But there's also a second point. Right? That's why it was created. We look at water and we see its purpose in creation, so now we know why it was created. But then we can ask, why is it created in this form? And so on. I mean, we can understand what water does now that we see its primary use. So that would be really a definition of what water is, and we see its primary use. So now we understand the intention of the Creator. Now we understand the object, and that was what King Solomon was pursuing in his life and in writing this work. I mean, in every aspect of a person's life. So to understand how he is to live means how he's to interact with everything around him. But to interact with things, whether it's a person or an animal or plants or minerals, or whether it's certain functions of the mind, certain psychological tendencies, hatred, anger, jealousy, anything. So what King Solomon did, he explored what was the purpose in its creation. Why did God make this thing? And also, why in this way? And in this fashion, he was able to answer whether or not sadness is better than folly, as he goes throughout the book. And we did that. We went through it. We showed how, in certain cases, he would say things that seemed to be opposites, but they really worked out not to be. I mean, they seemed to be contradictions, but they worked out not to be. Because you had to go through and see in what capacity were you giving in to a certain emotion. Sometimes in a certain context it's good, in another context it's bad. So it's a deep study, and there's a tremendous amount. But King Solomon, we know, was given knowledge miraculously at 12 years old when he became a king. God came to him in a vision, which makes him a prophet, and asked him, "Shalom Ma'atelach." And God says to King Solomon, "Ask what I should give to you." And he gave him, and he wanted knowledge and how to judge the people and how to educate the people. And God said, because you asked for this and not for the death of your enemies and not for wealth and so on, so I'm giving you everything because you have the right attitude. So you, if a person would have asked for the death of his enemies or for wealth, that means he had too much of an attachment to those things and that he would have abused it. But since King Solomon asked for intelligence, knowledge, so therefore he was able to receive the others because it was going to fit into the right context of an intelligent Torah lifestyle. So you see what he's saying here is that all this knowledge that he shared was knowledge that was based on trying to find out what is the real purpose in everything that was created. And in understanding the purpose, then a person could have the greatest life. Because then he's following the intent of the Creator. But you see, he does separate. Ibn Ezra does separate between why was something created, as opposed to it not being created, and also why was it created in this way. Meaning there's great wisdom to be derived from the way something is created too, and not just the fact that it is created. Okay. All right, any questions or comments up to this point? Okay. Right, so it's an interesting Ibn Ezra. That's Ibn Ezra on verse 10, 12:10. All right. Then we went on to 11. And we said, what does it mean? It says that the words of the wise man are like goads. They're like nails that are planted but have large heads. They have a head to the nail. They're given from one shepherd. Okay, so we didn't answer the one shepherd thing last week, but what we did say is that he's talking about the words of the wise. Why does he move on to that? We noted two things. One was that one was talking about the goad, something which steers an animal in a certain direction. So he said, just like in previous verse, in 10, he talks about words that are upright, meaning moral discipline, and words that are truthful, which talks about intelligence, because there's two areas of knowledge. There's areas of knowledge that have to do with true and false, and there's areas of knowledge that have to do with what is right or wrong. Those are the two areas that man is involved in. So just like he labor to bring those two areas to light for us. So this is the wise men also. The words are like goads. They're that which like steers the animal, the instinctual part of man, and like nails. So the nail we said is like a deep, it's like a driven. I'm not sure why. I was making a parallel last week, I believe. I said that there was the moral disciplines and also the intelligent truths, but I don't see it now in the verse. So I may have overstepped what I said last week, but nonetheless, he's referring to two different areas. And so perhaps because one is about animals, right, that's referring to the instinctual part of man, the moral, what's good or what's right or wrong, as opposed to what's true or false. Okay. That's what Ibn Ezra says. There are words from the earlier sages, the earlier people, maybe even the patriarchs he's referring to. They are like a goad for an animal, that it turns it and it makes the soul wise, he says. So it turns Shemayasrim, or it means rebuke, could be Musar. Umafakachim hanefesh, and it makes wise the soul. Then he says there are also nails that are planted that are very great, they're large. And they join the door, I guess, to the frame, and it shouldn't separate. And this is really the Torah of man, meaning that it's joining, like a door is joining to the frame, so the certain principles of the rabbis will join a person to the Torah. It will keep him aligned with a proper functioning. So it sounds now it's talking about the objective. That the words of desire, to find out the real purpose in things that were created and why they were created a certain way, but they're written, these words of the wise, are written to guide the person, emotionally, intellectually, to align him with the Torah lifestyle. But they're not simple matters. That's why he uses the term like a nail that's driven. It's very hard to pull out. Some nail that's forced into the wood, that's hammered in, meaning an idea of a great intelligent person is going to be difficult to really extract the truth, but that's why you have to labor over it. But nonetheless, they wrote it in the way that they have large heads to the nails. The large head, we said last week, according to the Sforno, that they have a way that you can grab onto it, like with a pliers, for any person who really desires to, and he can bring it out to light. He can bring out the idea. Those hammered nails of the rabbis, they could bring it out to light. So the rabbis wrote in a way where they gave you, in their statements, they gave you things you could latch onto, just like you could latch onto a nail's head and pull it out. So there are points within the statements of the rabbis. They're not completely concealed. They're not submerged below the surface that you have no way of accessing their ideas. They wrote in a way, not only that they contain truths, but they gave you points within there are statements that are like a head to a nail, that you could see something above the surface and you could even grab onto it and pull it out. So King Solomon is telling you that the ideas are driven there. They're hard to extract, but there is a method by which you can do it. And perhaps he's even alluding to his writing of Kohelis. That he too wrote in this way. So it could be, very interestingly, ironically, that this verse 11 is to the whole book of Kohelis, the nail's head. Meaning now that you come to the end of the book, and now you see him talking about that the words of the rabbis are written in a way that they're still, they may be deep, they may be hard to extract, but there is a head to the nail that you can grab onto. So now that King Solomon is telling us this in one of the last verses, now we can reflect back, and he's now telling us, look through the rest of the book now. There, I'm giving you a head to the nail. Of every point that I made, there is a method by which you can grab on and pull out the point that I'm trying to tell you. And knowledge is something which is deep. It's not something which, sometimes you see something and you think that that's all there is to the idea, or maybe you have a wrong idea about what the concept is. But there are areas that a person is not familiar with yet, so he can't understand what the words are that the rabbis wrote until he learns more. So that's one reason why there's such depth. Because you can ask, why are they writing in such a cryptic manner? So we're not talking about metaphors over here. Now he's talking about just the words of the rabbis when they tell you something. There may be a couple of statements that they're making. They may be addressing, like, a person may ask a great rabbi a question about business. And then the rabbi responds by saying, how old are you? So a person hears this, the rabbi's not answering my question. But if the person's intelligent, he's now going to think, why did the rabbi respond to my question about business by asking my age? Or maybe there's something about age that is relevant. Maybe I'm a little bit too young to be investigating business right now. I'm still I'm 15, and I'm asking the rabbi about business. Maybe he's indicating that I should be spend a little more time in your learning, get a better basis in your Torah studies before you enter the world of business. So with a simple statement, so we understand literally the words of the wise person who's talking to us, but the appreciation of why he said that, a kid at 15 is not going to know why. He'll probably ask his question again. He'll say, excuse me, Rabbi, but let me ask you a question. Maybe you didn't hear me. You know, can you tell me X, Y, and Z about business? But if a person is older, he knows that people work with depth, especially a great rabbi. So that's a very simplified example, but it illustrates how when the rabbi is right, that's what King Solomon here is saying. It's something which is deep. What are they addressing? What's the statement? How could King Solomon in one place be saying that what does simcha, you know, what does gladness do? And another place he says, oh, you know, gladness is to be praised. It sounds like a contradiction. He's criticizing gladness or happiness or just frivolity. In another place he's saying, oh, it's praised. So a person who is simple is going to look at that as a contradiction. A person who has depth, who has studied, so he'll look further and he'll start saying, what was the context that King Solomon was saying it? And then he'll start seeing differences in the verses. And those differences in the verses are the heads of the nail that allow the person to pull out, oh, I see why. In this case, King Solomon said that happiness is a waste of time because of X, Y, and Z reason. But in another case, he says happiness is a good, and that's because he's addressing a different context. Just like, you know, a person, just like mourning, a person is supposed to mourn a certain amount. But if he does too much, he's called a fool. So mourning could be referred to as both the right thing to do and the wrong thing, depending on the context. So context is one consideration in terms of explaining difficulties that we find. Maybe we have to look further. But there's many reasons why we can look at something that the rabbi's right, and we can have a difficulty with it. But we do understand that there's depth, like a nail that's driven. And we'll have to work hard to extract what the idea is that is below the surface. And perhaps that's what he's alluding to as well when he says that it's given over from one shepherd at the end of verse 11. And one of the commentaries is referring to it means God. I think two actually refer to it as being God, that these ideas that the rabbis are giving over, like nails that are, they have large heads, you can pull it out, but they're given over, these ideas are given over from one shepherd. So what do you mean shepherd? So shepherd is the one who guides others. And that ultimately is God. It's true that there's prophets as well that were shepherds in that respect. But we speak about God as being a shepherd, that he's guiding man a certain way. But by saying that he's one shepherd, meaning that all these ideas that the rabbis are giving are coming from the one, the creator. And this adds to the appreciation we have to have for the wisdom that we're trying to extract from the rabbi's words. If it's all really emanating, it's God's knowledge that we're looking to uncover, that gives us all the more reason to for pause and caution and not to say something too quickly or too superficially. So that explains why it's together in this verse, because this verse is telling us about the depth of the knowledge that's at hand. He says at the beginning of Mishlei too, he talks about that if a person desires wisdom, he has to dig for it like a buried treasure. And he says, "Oz, tov in yiras Hashem." Then you'll have, you'll understand the fear of God, and the knowledge of God will you find. because a person has to have the attitude that it's a buried treasure, meaning there's a great thing below the surface. Knowledge is something which is, there's a little bit that's sticking above the surface, the head and nail, but the, if you have to have the attitude, meaning the another point is that not only is it worth so much, but your attitude towards it should be that you should be thirsty for it, like it's a great treasure. If you have that attitude, then that you'll have the energy to pursue, to endure the search until you uncover the real priceless gems. And also, it teaches that since a person's looking at it like a treasure, if he looks for ideas as he's learning and he's in his Torah studies, and he sees and he hears somebody say a simplistic answer to something, he knows that can't be the treasure. A treasure is like a fine ruby. It's something like a precious diamond. And it has to have that brilliance. I mean, if a person doesn't really come up with a tremendous insight, so he's not really hitting the core. He's not really uncovering the idea that's being shared by God, by the rabbis, by the prophets. So there's a number of ideas enclosed, again, in that one statement of King Solomon. He says that if you search it out for like silver, and you look for it like a buried treasure, then you'll understand the fear of God, and the knowledge of God will you find. So in that one statement, referring it as treasure, he's telling you that you have to have a dissatisfaction with a simple type of answer when you are uncovering new ideas in Torah. And he's telling you about the attitude, because treasure means that a person is going after it with all of his energy. He's not going to eat or sleep until he finds it. So there's a number of ideas just by calling something a treasure. So again, being a prophet and being divinely inspired in these writings. So King Solomon is writing those words in Mishlei, in Proverbs. We have to stop. So what is he saying over here? Here's another verse. Here's something we have to look at carefully at all different angles and see what is he talking about. What is the ideas that he's trying to share with us? That's a very important lesson. A person can't be looking through his studies and just to rush through it quickly, and it's covering ground. That's not the purpose. The Talmud says the purpose of learning is to get the definitions, to really define things, to take the time to refine an idea. It could be that's why he goes into the next verse in 12 and he says, on top of this, my son, be careful from making many books. Maybe there it's one aspect of making many books means that a person's just covering a lot of ground, but he's not spending the time to really see, like he said earlier in the Ibn Ezra, to understand why was this thing created and why was it created in this way. You know, those are the two questions we have to keep in mind when we pursue our studies. And it doesn't matter whether it's to be in studying the physical world or the world of Torah, philosophy and law and halacha, Jewish law. All right. Any questions or comments? Yeah, it's amazing. I'm sure King Solomon and all of the patriarchs, they had the same amazement about how it's just constantly unfolding without end. Yeah, that's true, but, you know, so that's good. It should give us, energy to try to focus more.
Yes.
But that's the human condition. I mean, sometimes people do get caught up. And there are issues that are important. The person has to take time out of things. He has to take, you know, he has to earn a living. He has to address people's needs. You know, he has to do certain things that are maybe prefer not to, but, you know, justice and, you know, harmony in the community demand that he do it. And sometimes you just have to know whether you're exhausted. You just need a little, you know, downtime for yourself. So, you know, day by day, each day, we just, you know, we assess it daily. And wherever we can improve, of course, we try to.
Is it true that our forefathers and foremothers had much more sense about life?
Of course.
Yes.
They were prophets. God doesn't speak to every person. If he's speaking to a person, that means they raise themselves to a tremendous level. Anybody else? Nashon? Carol and Jim, any questions?
No, Robin.
No, I'm good.
Good. Okay, so maybe we'll wrap it up here. And pick up next week. We'll move on then to, I think it's just the two last verses. Actually, three more. So we have 12, 13, and 14. All right, so we'll try to address that next week. If not, you know, the week after. But we'll pick up next week, same time. All right?
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Robin.
Okay, everybody. Have a great week.
Great week.
You too, Robin.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.